Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
It's 7 a.m. in Seoul, 10 a.m. in Sindhi, and 6 p.m. here in New York. I'm Julia Chatterley, and wherever you are in the world, this is your First Move. A warm welcome once again to First Move, and here's today's Need to Know. United by the China Challenge, U.S. President Joe Biden welcomes the Japanese Prime Minister to the White House. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says no force in the world will stop Israeli troops from entering Rafah. Arizona's Supreme Court revives a near-total abortion ban enacted in 1864. And a climate change conquest, a group of Swiss women win a landmark case at the European Court of Human Rights. The consequences for governments could be huge. All that and more coming up. But we do begin the hour in Washington, D.C., as the official visit of Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida to the United States formally gets underway. Kishida and his wife are set to arrive at the White House to greet President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden any moment now. The summit between the U.S. and Japan coming at a critical time in the relations between the two nations as they confront a more assertive China in the Indo-Pacific region. Biden and Kishida are set to strengthen their already close security relationship. They will also hold a first ever trilateral summit with the presidents of Philippines, Fernando Marcos Jr. Together, the three nations have a complex, turbulent history. Yet the threat that China poses, particularly in the South China Sea, with Taiwan, North Korea, even relations with Russia, are all common causes to unite them. Biden and Kishida will also discuss the close economic relationship between their two nations, including whether the U.S. administration can see a way to greenlight Nippon Steel's $14 billion offer to buy U.S. steel. So far, President Biden has voiced opposition. And later in the show, we will hear from the CEO of Japanese consumer products giant Suntory Holdings, who will be at the state dinner for Prime Minister Kishida held at the White House on Wednesday. His thoughts on the U.S.-China relationship. Doing business in China is a major Japanese and international business leader. Defending the Japanese homeland, the impact, of course, of the rise in defense spending and much more. And the moment that we see Prime Minister Kishida and his wife arrive at the White House for that meet and greet, we were looking at live pictures there, we will bring them to you. There you go. There's the picture there as we await their imminent arrival. We should see President Biden and his wife, of course, Dr. Jill Biden, the Japanese Prime Minister, and his wife as well arriving. When we see that, we will take you there live. But for now, we'll move on. The State Department says Israel has not briefed the United States on the date set for the invasion of Rafah. That's Gaza's southernmost city, where around 1.5 million Palestinians are now sheltering. Meanwhile, the Israeli Prime Minister insisting today that, quote, no force in the world will stop his troops from entering Rafah, and that the IDF must finish the job against Hamas. Jeremy Diamond has more and a warning. His report does contain graphic images, including pictures of those recovered from Al-Shifa Hospital.
Palestinians pick through the rubble in the wake of a major Israeli withdrawal. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is vowing this reprieve in the fighting will not last.
We will complete the elimination of Hamas's battalions, including in Rafah. No force in the world will stop us.
Netanyahu's bellicose rhetoric coming after he faced recriminations from his right flank, with Israel's National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir threatening to pull out of the government if the war ends without an invasion of Rafah. Overnight, Israel's military focused on threats from outside Gaza. fending off the latest attack from Houthi militants in Yemen. For the first time, Israel's Sea Dome air defense system, a ship-mounted version of the Iron Dome, shooting down a Houthi drone over the Red Sea. Tonight, Israel's security cabinet convening to discuss start and stop negotiations over a potential ceasefire and hostage release deal. For now, a deal seems out of reach. In a statement, Hamas says Israel's latest position has not responded to any of the demands of our people and our resistance.
The ball is in Hamas's court. The world is watching to see what it does.
Hamas continuing to insist on the total withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza and unfettered access for Palestinians seeking to return to northern Gaza. The ratio of Palestinian prisoners to be released in exchange for 40 Israeli hostages also still being negotiated. Amid the ruins of Gaza's largest hospital, Palestinian crews and UN agencies sift through mounds of dirt and shallow mass graves, exhuming the bodies of dozens who were killed during the Israeli military's two-week assault on the hospital, where Israel says it was battling Hamas militants. Gaza's civil defense says 381 bodies have been recovered so far, in an effort to give some peace to the dead and their loved ones. 3 weeks after Hassan Kuneta says his 83-year-old father was detained by the Israeli army, he has found what remains of his body. We've been looking for almost a week since they withdrew from the area until this moment, he says. 5 minutes ago, my nephew called me and told me they found the body over there. That sense of closure is cold comfort for Hassan and his family. But others, like Dr. Nuha Suailem, are looking for just that. I came to look for my husband, she says, explaining that he is a doctor who was detained by the Israeli military. Now she does not know if he is alive or dead. Where are they? She cries. We don't know if they are arrested or detained, underground or above ground. Where are they? Tell us where they are. Tell me where my husband is. Search for answers that is far from over. Jeremy Diamond, CNN, Jerusalem.
And now, as I mentioned moments ago, Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida and his wife Yuko arriving at the White House for a visit before the leaders of the two nations formally begin their summit and discussions on Wednesday. And there you can see them there. Dr. Jill Biden, of course, President Biden, Prime Minister of Japan Fumio Kishida and his wife Yoko, the first time that we've seen a leader from Japan represented here at the White House in almost 10 years. So a pivotal moment, a historic moment, I think, for these two nations, particularly with the discussions to come. MJ Lee is at the White House for us. MJ, two nations united, I think, in their desire to keep the Indo-Pacific region, as they would describe it, free and open, and recognizing, I think, that if there is a more material conflict, whether it's Japan, China, the South China Sea, Taiwan, North Korea, they'll both certainly be involved. What does the United States hope to achieve with the discussions this week?
You know, if I could first help set the scene here a little bit, obviously we just saw the Japanese Prime Minister arriving here at the White House, and what we will see over the next day and a half or so is really a lot of pomp and circumstance, in addition to the serious diplomatic work that is going to unfold as well. Just to give you a sense, tomorrow we will see President Biden and Prime Minister Kishida have a bilateral meeting followed by a news conference. And then in the evening, the day is capped off with a lavish state dinner. And, you know, you talk about pomp and circumstance, and there are few occasions here at the White House where you see that on more vivid display than a state dinner. The First Lady's office and a number of the White House chefs just briefed reporters about the decadent menu that we will see tomorrow, the lavish decorations, all as a tribute to the U.S. Japanese relationship. And then as for the diplomatic bilateral work that we will see in the next day or so, we do expect an announcement, a major update on the two countries' military alliance, We also expect to see an update on the two countries' defense industrial cooperation and other areas of cooperation, we are told by U.S. officials, including artificial intelligence on cybersecurity, semiconductor production, and even space collaboration. And also it goes without saying, of course, that there are going to be some areas of friction between the two countries that the leaders will likely discuss, including Japan's desire to purchase U.S. steel. Now, I should also note, after the bilateral visit and this visit from the Japanese prime minister later this week, we will see President Biden hosting the first ever summit between the U.S., Japan, and the Philippines. This, of course, gets at the broader strategy that we've seen from the Biden administration that is aimed at containing China's strength and aggression in the region. That, of course, has been sort of a hallmark of the Biden presidency's strategy when it comes to the Indo-Pacific.
MG, it's going to be an interesting few days to see what comes of this, whether it's in deal making or discussions or beyond. And that trilateral summit, as you mentioned, with the president of the Philippines is going to be fascinating to watch. Great to have you with us. Thank you. MJ Lee there at the White House. Now, Arizona could become the 15th U.S. state to ban abortion with very limited exceptions. That's after the state's Supreme Court revived a law dating back to 1864, banning the procedure except in the case of saving the mother's life. The ruling could have far-reaching consequences for women's health and for election year politics in a battleground state and beyond. Ellie Honig joins me now. Ellie, I think we have to start with the basics here. How did we get to a point where you've got a state upholding a law that dates back to 1864, before actually women had the right to vote in the state and actually before Arizona was considered a state in the first place? How did we get here?
Julia, that's a great question. So this story really starts 2 years ago when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade. That was the Supreme Court ruling that had been in place for 50 years and protected a woman's right to an abortion across the United States. Now, 2 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court reversed that in a case called Dobbs, and that essentially said, we're going to leave it up to each state individually to decide what its laws will be on abortion. And as a result, we've seen wide divergence. There's some states where women have full rights to abortions and other states, including now Arizona, where it's been completely outlawed. And you're right, this is a bizarre scenario where this 160-plus year statute has suddenly been revived, and according to the Arizona Supreme Court, now that will be the law of the state for the time being.
It's unclear how and whether and when this law will be enforced. I saw some comments from the Attorney General, Democratic Attorney General, I should say, Chris Mays, who said she would not prosecute anyone under the law, but local prosecutors could still do so. I mean, there's no ability to appeal this, but if your prosecutors perhaps are saying, hang on a second, Ellie, how do we move on from this moment?
So that's a really good point. First of all, the state attorney general in Arizona has said that they will not enforce this particular law. And I will say that is within a prosecutor's purview. We have something in the United States called prosecutorial discretion. It happens not uncommonly that prosecutors say, I will not enforce the laws against, for example, marijuana in recent years, certain prosecutors have said. But as you said, the other issue, though, is you have county level district attorneys who may not agree with that, and they're on their own. Now, there are a couple things legally that might happen to change this. First of all, the law is on hold for at least a couple weeks. Second of all, the Arizona State Legislature can repeal, can undo this law, and there actually is some bipartisan support. There are some Republicans in Arizona who've expressed support for repealing it. And then the final option is Arizona can amend its own state constitution. Now, that's a complicated process. You would, again, need some sort of bipartisan support. They could theoretically appeal this to the U.S. Supreme Court. But as we said in the beginning, the U.S. Supreme Court has said it's up to you, states. So the Supreme Court is not going to be an answer here.
I'm going to ask you to expand upon your remit beyond the legal sphere into the political sphere, because I'm sure for our international audience, they'll be wondering to your point about the politics here. And it does matter to what extent, whether it's Arizona or beyond, this plays into the 2024 elections in this country. If you want to see something different, does it come down to how you vote?
So abortion has consistently been polling as one of the top two or three issues that voters care about in the United States. And when the Supreme Court reversed Roe versus Wade 2 years ago, there was a lot of uncertainty. How is this going to play politically? And we've actually been surprised. We've seen certain states that lean conservative that have actually passed measures upholding abortion rights, including Ohio and Kansas and other states. So I think politicians on both sides of the aisle have been surprised at the strength of the reaction against Dobbs, which overturned Roe versus Wade. I think Republicans, and you can even see this in the statement that Donald Trump released just yesterday, are recognizing that taking extreme stances on abortion, like we see in Arizona, has been hurting them politically. And on the flip side, I think we see Democrats trying to capitalize on that. And Julia, if this stays on the ballot, that could spur voter turnout in Arizona in 2024, which will be one of the very few swing states which will likely decide the presidential election.
We're also waiting for the Supreme Court, Ellie, very quickly to give their verdict on whether or not to restrict access to a pill for abortion as well. And that's something else now that we're watching. How might that also play into this, particularly for a state like Arizona that we said is effectively going back to the dark ages here to potentially restrict abortions, and particularly in cases even where there's rape or incest in this case? How might that abortion pill access play into this?
So the Supreme Court is in the process of deciding a case about the availability of mifepristone, which is an abortion medication that's commonly used in the United States. Based on the oral argument that happened a couple weeks ago, it looks like the Supreme Court is probably going to keep availability to mifepristone in place, but they're considering whether to scale it back considerably, which, put on top of all the decisions that have come out the Supreme Court recently, I think would further elevate this as a political hot button.
Yes, underscoring the previous answer.
Right.
Ellie Ernick, thank you so much for your wisdom.
Thanks,
great.
All right,
now to an unprecedented legal case here in the United States. A judge has sentenced the parents of a school shooter to 10 to 15 years in prison. James and Jennifer Crumley were both found guilty of involuntary manslaughter in separate trials over the death of four Oxford High School students who were gunned down by their son Ethan back in 2021. Jurors found the couple ignored their son's mental health issues and bought him the gun he used in the attack. Jean Casares has more on the case that's gripped America.
It is the sentence of this court, Ms. Crumley, that you serve 10 to 15 years. As to defendant James Crumley, it is the sentence of this court that you serve 10 to 15 years.
Historic sentences handed down for the parents of a teen who killed four students at a Michigan high school in 2021.
It is a goal of sentencing to act as a deterrent. These convictions are not about poor parenting. These convictions confirm repeated acts or lack of acts that could have halted an oncoming runaway train.
James and Jennifer Crumley were found guilty of involuntary manslaughter in separate trials earlier this year, the first time parents of a mass school shooter have been held directly accountable for an attack. On November 30, 2021, their son killed Madison Baldwin, Tate Meir, Justin Schilling, and Hannah St. Juliana at Oxford High School, using a gun gifted to him by Jennifer and her husband.
The blood of our children is on your hands, too.
Family of the victims gave statements ahead of the sentencing.
When you worried about what people thought of you and feeling threatened, I was learning your son threatened my daughter and fatally shot her in the head. While you were hiding, I was planning her funeral. And while you were running away from your son and your responsibilities, I was forced to do the worst possible thing a parent could do. I was forced to say goodbye to my Madison.
The older sister of 14-year-old victim Hannah St. Juliana says no punishment will ever be enough.
I now have to live without Hannah, my little sister, my best friend, my other half. To me, that makes the maximum sentence being 15 years too short. Hannah didn't even have 15 years to live.
Hannah's murder has destroyed a large portion of my very soul.
Both Crumley spoke up on their own behalf. James Crumley, for the first time since his trial began.
To the victims and the families, I stand today not to ask for your forgiveness, as I know it may be beyond reach, but to express my sincerest apologies for the pain that has been caused. I will be in my own internal prison for the rest of my life.
I really want the families to know how truly sorry I am, and I'll continue to feel this pain for the rest of my life as well. If I could go back and change things, if I could go back and do things differently, and maybe none of us would be here today.
Okay, coming up on First Move, a landmark climate change ruling in Europe with potential global implications. Can a nation violate a citizen's human rights by doing too little to tackle climate change? That's next.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
Lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to First Move. And for all our viewers in the US, UK and Latin America, we hope you're having a terrific Tuesday. For everyone beginning their day with us in Asia, happy Wednesday. Although it's a turbulent Tuesday on Wall Street, topping our money move today. Volatile action for much of the session with the Nasdaq and the S&P closing higher, however. Continued nervousness before Wednesday's crucial report on US consumer inflation happening here. A hot inflation print would raise fresh doubt over whether the Federal Reserve can cut interest rates anytime soon. In the meantime, a mixed session in Asia. Japanese stocks outperforming for a second straight session, with consumer confidence there rising to its highest level in 5 years. And an international court handing down a landmark decision Tuesday, potentially opening the floodgates for future lawsuits. The European Court of Human Rights ruled that Switzerland violated human rights by not doing more to address the impact of the climate crisis. The ruling could force Switzerland to further reduce its use of fossil fuels and possibly push other European nations to do the same. It's the first time the court has ruled on a climate lawsuit. And more importantly, the judgment is legally binding. The case was brought by more than 2,000 Swiss women who argued that climate change hurt their health and their quality of life. Claire Sebastian has more on what this might mean for climate activism in the future.
Well, the fact that three cases claiming government alleged inaction on climate change violates people's human rights made it to the European Court of Human Rights in the first place was already groundbreaking. But the fact that one of the cases was partially successful is another major milestone for climate activists. It explicitly links national climate change policies with a state's duty to protect the human rights of its citizens. And it bolsters, of course, the body of proof that litigation can be an effective tool alongside global treaties to force governments to do more to stop global warming. Experts and activists say this will open the floodgates to more cases in Europe and globally, where there is a growing trend of human rights cases being brought over climate change. That a view shared by Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg.
This is only the beginning of climate litigation. All over the world, more and more people are taking their government to court, holding them responsible for their actions. The result of this can mean in no way that we lean back. This means that we have to fight even more, since this is only the beginning.
Well, the two other cases, including one attempting to force 32 countries to do more to prevent global warming, were dismissed for technical reasons. But the court's ruling in the Swiss case is binding, with no option to appeal. Switzerland will now be compelled to act, including possibly reducing its greenhouse gas consumption. The Swiss government says it's analysing the judgment and the, quote, measures Switzerland has to take for the future. Claire Sebastian, CNN, London.
It's going to be fascinating to see how the government responds now. OK, stay with CNN. We'll be right back. OK, welcome back to First Move and a look at more of the international headlines this hour. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says his country will lose its war with Russia if the US doesn't approve more military aid. And he warned that if that happens, other nations will also be attacked. So far, the US Republican House Speaker is refusing to hold a vote on passing a spending package for Ukraine. A judge has denied yet another bid from former President Donald Trump to delay the start of his hush money trial next Monday. Trump has asked for a ruling on his gag order in the case. That challenge will still continue. It just won't be required to happen before the trial. Trump has repeatedly tried to postpone the start of the New York trial, so far unsuccessfully. Ireland swore in its youngest ever prime minister on Tuesday. Simon Harris follows Leo Varadkar, who resigned suddenly last month. Harris used his first speech after being elected to condemn Israel's conduct in Gaza. He faces some daunting political challenges, including unfavorable polls and a general election. And turning now to Gaza, Israel's war against Hamas is sparking fresh tensions in its relationship with Turkey. Turkey announced on Tuesday that it will restrict key exports to Israel until there's a ceasefire in Gaza and sufficient humanitarian aid deliveries to Gazan residents. Scott McLean has more.
Since the war in Gaza began, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been one of the loudest voices against Israel, calling it a terrorist state, accusing it of genocide, and even making this comparison. Is there anything Netanyahu does that is less than Hitler? No, he said in December. But despite the bark, there's been no bite until now. There can be no excuse to Israel preventing our attempt to send aid from the air to our Gazan brothers who are fighting hunger, said Hakan Fidan. In response to this situation, we have decided to take a series of new measures against Israel. After Turkey accused Israel of rejecting a Turkish request to airdrop aid to Gaza, Turkey's foreign minister promised consequences. Ankara has now banned the export of some metals, cement, industrial machinery, more than 50 products to Israel until it agrees to a ceasefire in Gaza and allows for the uninterrupted flow of humanitarian aid. The Israeli foreign minister promised to retaliate with its own export bans aimed at Turkey's inflation-battered economy and said Erdogan is once again sacrificing the economic interests of the people of Turkey for his support of the Hamas murderers in Gaza.
While Turkish-Israeli political relations have been hot and cold through the years, lately economic ties have only been warming, with annual trade volume now into the billions. And while there were some smaller organized boycotts of Israel in Turkey at the outset of the war, Erdogan's government has long resisted calls to cut trade with Israel.
Well, there's no talk about sanctions at this point.
This was Erdogan's chief advisor in December.
But of course, the relationship is strained.
President Erdogan has called Israel a terrorist state. Yeah. And I wonder why Turkey thinks it's okay to do business with a terrorist state.
Well, I mean, you're saying business, but the fact is that there are certain companies that are based in Turkey, certain companies that are based in Israel. This is not a state-to-state issue.
This week, police detained dozens of protesters on Istanbul's famous Istiklal Street, who were calling for Turkey to cut off trade with Israel. And in local elections less than 2 weeks ago, Erdogan was dealt a stinging defeat. As smaller parties promising to take stronger action against Israel siphoned off votes from his ruling AK party.
You think that President Erdogan has heard the message from voters loud and clear?
Oh yeah, this is a very clear message. Wherever you look, you see pro-government groups talking about how government failed to respond to domestic pressure, domestic demands about the Gaza war and about the economy, and how the government failed to notice that complaints were this big before.
Scott McLean, CNN, Istanbul.
think that is...
Residents in the Russian town of Orsk are angry about what they see as a lack of action to devastating floods. A state of emergency has been declared after the worst flooding ever recorded in the region. More than 10,000 residential buildings have been evacuated, and President Vladimir Putin so far has no plans to visit the area. Isa Suarez has more on the disaster.
Catastrophic flooding and thousands of lives appended across several regions in Russia, forcing many to evacuate with just their pets and a handful of belongings. At least three people are reported to have died so far. Authorities declared a state of emergency in the Orenburg region near Kazakhstan. After the Ural, Europe's third longest river, swelled several meters and burst through a dam embankment in Orsk, a city of more than 200,000 residents. The anger there was palpable on Monday, with protesters chanting "Shame on you" at local officials and "Putin help" over the government's response. "No one is helping us here," a man in this crowd shouts. "The state is doing nothing," he says. The city mayor said the flood has now peaked, according to Russian state news agency TASS. And the Kremlin spokesperson described the deluge in these regions as inevitable due to an abnormal increase in water levels. Dmitry Peskov also said that President Vladimir Putin is currently not planning on visiting the affected areas. Across the border in Kazakhstan, the country's president said the floods were his country's worst natural disaster in decades. In Russia, the country's emergency situations minister flew over some of the flooded zones on Tuesday to inspect the damage. And over in the Kurgan region, melting ice and torrential rains caused another river to overflow. "This is not a joke," the regional governor says bluntly. "Leave, take your papers, valuables, children, elderly relatives with limited mobility. You need to do this now," he says. Flood waters in Kurgan are expected to rise even higher over the next 48 hours, putting thousands more lives at risk and wreaking even more havoc. Isa Suarez, CNN, London.
Okay, coming up on First Move, the Japanese Prime Minister at the White House, what it means for the Japanese business community, what's their message? My conversation with the CEO of Suntory next.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back to First Move. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida visiting President Biden in Washington ahead of Wednesday's official meeting at the White House and the state banquet later that evening. Earlier Tuesday, the Prime Minister visited Arlington National Cemetery and attended a roundtable hosted by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. The summit between the United States and Japan coming at a critical time in relations between the two nations as they confront a more assertive China in the Indo-Pacific region and have concerns over nations like North Korea, of course, and the challenges surrounding Taiwan and their relationship with China. Now, earlier today, I sat down with the CEO of Suntory, Takeshi Nyanami, and I asked him what the message was from Japanese and Japan's business community.
"We will tighten the relation between Japan and the U.S. In both areas, business and the government, working together, especially toward the deterrence against any kind of what if. So just like North Korea, China. So we work together between U.S. and Japan so that we keep the order in Asia. That makes us feel doing more business in Asia, perhaps including China. But I don't know yet about what to do with China.
What would it take, speaking of China, for you to say, okay, now I'm comfortable enough to invest, to hire people in China? Because I think at this moment, and it's not you, it's other nations around the world, it's a huge opportunity, but the risk reward at this moment is not there. What would it take?
Two factors. One is Anti-Espionage Act, because including Americans, including lots of countries in democracy, including, of course, Japanese people are arrested. Mm. We don't know why they are arrested. So we feel so fear to visit Beijing, Shanghai, those cities. Though we know the relation between Japan and China is, we can't cut it off because we are so much intertwined. Knowing that, whether we invest or not, the second factor is IP protection.
Right.
We are not sure about that. So China will be able to join the CPTPP in terms of a high standard. I think we can invest freely to China, but I don't know when that'll happen.
Defense spending, I think, is something for Japan that's going to be very much a focus, whether it's the business relations and how that works. But it also means a fundamental mental shift for the Japanese people as well. What do you think what we're seeing now in Japan means in terms of psychology, whether it's perhaps a bad thing in certain respects, but also a good thing in terms of a greater sense perhaps of immediacy and risk? A necessity to adjust.
I think the Japanese public nowadays admit that we have to increase our self-defensing capabilities.
Right.
Working with the U.S., but the more we have to think that we have to protect our own country on our own instead of asking for allied countries led by U.S. So I think most general public of Japan approved already that we should increase expenditures to military. But we don't talk so detail. And the grand picture is fine, but what to do with the detail, such as what kind of armaments, weapons, what kind of protection for the country, what is the best for us, is will be in discussion. So we decided to increase, but how to make use of it is undecided. Well, we know the plan, but we have to, the general public have to discuss openly more.
Yeah, just saying it doesn't necessarily mean doing it.
Exactly, you're right. And what is the most effective way? And what to do with the defense industry of Japan? It's almost nothing. So should we rely on the US or allied countries totally? Not really. But we have to maybe join the AUKUS, working with the Australia, UK, and the United States. Maybe JACAS, I don't know. But we have to be working together to seek efficiency eventually. And it's from tax revenue.
Yeah. Paying for it,
right,
to your point, is another aspect of this. Fast forward 5 years. Is Japan in a stronger politically and economic position than it is today, in your mind?
I think it will be stronger. I mean, much stronger from now, though our political arena is in big challenge from society because of scandals and so forth that happens in many democracies. But I think economy and government policy making both are in good direction for Japan. I think because of we are getting out of deflation, which lasted as long as 30 years. So the landscape of Japan has been changing. But we business leaders have to decide how we can pick up the wages and make it sustainable, working with the government, for example. Government takes care of people like retraining, like digital, like the management capability. So we have to work together toward the good trajectory for Japan. I think that will happen.
I think you're a pragmatist. I also think you're an optimist. What gives you hope, other than watching First Move, of course, on CNN?
Yes, of course, your program. And plus, I think a younger generation is taking lots of risks, like startups, which is peculiar and very unique in our culture. And risk money is now available. Even Bank of Japan started to raise interest rates. But I think startups and the younger generation, those are keys.
Because they're not afraid of failing.
Those who haven't experienced the bubble burst, they don't have the risk-aversive position which my generation has, but that they are more or less unleashed from that trauma which we got through the bubble times.
Let's hope they never experience it.
Tech, good. Thank
you're the
you
best.
So much.
Thank you, sir.
Julia.
And we'll hear more from him later on in the week about the business of whiskey in particular. It's great. All right, next. UConn Gold, Connecticut's college basketball stars take the NCAA title after a thrilling final game. More coming up. Welcome back to First Move and to a slam dunk performance in men's basketball after a season that has thrilled fans across the United States and beyond. The UConn Huskies have claimed the biggest prize in the college division, winning back-to-back championships in the NCAA. They beat the Purdue Boilermakers 75-60 to claim the title. Many eyes were on the player of the year, Zach Edey, who led all scorers with 37 points despite his team's loss. UConn is the first Division I men's team to win back-to-back championships since the Florida Gators in 2006 to 2007. Coy Wire has more on an electrifying end to the college season.
Purdue's 7'4", two-time National Player of the Year, Zach Edey, had 37 points, 10 rebounds, but UConn was just too much. They are a collection of selfless players like 7'2", Donovan Klingon, Tristan Newton, Stephon Castle, and Samson Johnson.
UConn can bring this lead to double five. Lob it up, Samson Johnson cuts, Newton comes to the ball, another one, special delivery to Johnson.
Johnson raining down with two thunderous dunks, putting an exclamation point on what would become a dominant win. In front of more than 74,000 fans in State Farm Stadium, UConn steamrolls Purdue 75-60 to become the first repeat champ since 2007. Coach Dan Hurley's 12 straight tournament wins, all by double digits, is a tournament record. I caught up with Coach as he stepped off the court as a champion again.
Coach, what's that mean, cutting down those debts this time?
Oh, man, unbelievable. Feels like last year.
Any different?
Just incredible performance. To beat a team like Purdue the way we did, just incredible.
And you dominated every team along the way. How? Why?
Yeah, we're the best program in the country right now. We've got all the right players.
Hold on. You need to get that coach. What do you have to say to all the fans watching back home?
Oh, I know they can't wait for us to get back. We'll see them at the airport. We'll see them in Gamble. And I cannot wait for the parade, yeah. Man.
How are you going to celebrate tonight, Coach?
We're going to have some cocktails, I think.
Let's go, baby! Coach, what do you have to say to all your seniors who poured their hearts out for you?
I mean, incredible. The legacy they're leaving in a place that's hard to leave a legacy. just a place that's impossible to be historical players and to have legacies that are as good as anyone that's ever put the uniform on. It's hard to do at UConn, so couldn't be prouder, and we're going to miss them a lot.
Congrats, champ. Times two.
Let's go, man.
Fans back on campus in Storrs, Connecticut, elated as they celebrated the school's sixth national title since 1999. It's been a quarter century of dominance. The last two tournaments, UConn has beaten their opponents by an average of 20 points. And against non-conference opponents, they have a record of 33-1, with all of those wins by double digits as well. When I asked Coach Hurley this week to describe the mental makeup of his team, he said, relentless. There's only been one program that's ever been able to pull off a three-peat, UCLA about a half a century ago. Now UConn will get their chance.
Now, a rare total solar eclipse swept across North America on Monday, plunging parts of Mexico, the U.S. and Canada into darkness in the middle of the day. Millions of people were treated to a spectacular view as the moon blocked the sun. But it wasn't just humans who were affected by the heavens. Animals could also be seen to be behaving in rather unusual ways too. Ed Levandera has more.
It was like momentarily walking into the classic comedy Night at the Museum, a glimpse into the secret lives of animals at the Dallas Zoo when humans aren't around to watch.
Zebra started chasing him, and then the ostriches got into the mix as well.
Just as the zoo slipped into total darkness, a jolt of, well, animal energy seemed to shoot through the grounds. The moment mesmerized Lisa Van Sleet, a curator of mammals at the Dallas Zoo.
So did the total eclipse day meet your expectations?
It exceeded my expectations today. There was a lot more activity than I expected to see out of the animals.
Just before total darkness, an ostrich laid an egg and hovered over it for a time, protecting it. Zoo officials say it's not clear if the moment was caused by the eclipse, but that the timing was certainly curious, they said. Guinea fowl suddenly crowed wildly.
I hear the birds are starting.
The birds are getting louder.
Yeah.
Just before the moon covered the sun for almost 4 minutes, a young giraffe and its mother galloped around the enclosure. The zebras joined in the chase as well. Here and around the country, elephants grouped together and appeared to head back to the area where they sleep. Flamingos packed together in the middle of a pond in their habitat. Primates apparently also thought it was bedtime. Animal experts say the sudden darkness triggered a natural reaction among many of the animals.
At nighttime, predators go out a lot more, and so they have to kind of huddle together to be safety in numbers and in case something's coming. So they went into that instinct pretty quickly.
At this doggy daycare in the Dallas area, this group of dogs seemed to stop, confused by the sudden darkness. When the sun returned, the dogs started playing around again. Another video captured a cat wanting to come inside its home when darkness struck. At the Toledo Zoo, a polar bear didn't seem to care about all the fuss, nonchalantly dove into the water before the sun disappeared. Texas Parks and Wildlife officials teamed up with NASA to set up these acoustic recording devices to monitor the sounds of animals in the wild. But not all animals were flustered or impressed by the total eclipse. Tobogo the giraffe mostly walked around, unfazed, ready to start chewing on the lettuce the humans feed him when the sun came back.
Because a total eclipse is so rare, there's very little documentation, very few studies that have been done on animal behavior during a total eclipse. Because of that, zoo officials say they plan on sharing their observations and the data they gather, not just with other zoos that were in the path of this eclipse, but as well as with other zoos across the country. Ed Levandera, CNN, Dallas.
My soul animal was the one that was more interested in food there than whatever else was going on. All right, and finally, on First Move, Scrabble is one of the most beloved board games on the market, but it is perhaps too challenging and competitive for a younger generation. Just asking. Mattel is releasing a new version of the game called Scrabble Together for sale in Europe. Now, one side of the board is the original game. The other side is a, quote, less intimidating version. Instead of competing, players collaborate on words. There's also helper cards if players get stuck. Mattel says its research shows younger players just aren't as ruthless as they used to be. I suppose that means a fewer people will be hurling letters across the room and upending the board in frustration. I never did that, by the way. I just read a dictionary to ensure I won. And that just about wraps up the show. Thank you for joining us. I'll see you tomorrow.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.